Andrea from Lemoore, California, and you're watching Gospel Tangents, your best source for Mormon history, science, and theology.
I'm Rick Bennett. Following the death of Joseph Smith in June of 1844, Brigham Young led the Saints west to the territory of Deseret and tried to establish theodemocracy among the Saints here in what is now known as Utah. It went surprisingly well. In our next conversation with Dr. Derek Sainsbury, we'll talk about Brigham Young's attempts to bring theodemocracy to Utah. Check out our conversation. All right, so we've talked about kind of how the southern area. Were they more receptive in the northern states to his message?
Yeah, they were more receptive in Michigan, in Ohio, in New York, in New York City, and in Boston. And these are areas too where there is a lot of abolitionist kind of thinking, right? And Joseph Smith's call for a federal bank, that's a Whig issue. And they like that. And then again, you've got all of these people too that are not happy with the Whigs and the Democrats and are looking for something else. And this is kind of supplying it. Now, when we say acceptance, I don't know what that translates into, right? They weren't beating them up or whatever. But even then, like the most famous moment probably in the campaign is the Boston Conference that happens in the Meladonin Assembly Hall. It's a big, important, popular hall in Boston that they rent out. And it's covered by all the newspapers. It's packed to the brim. It's actually July 1st, so Joseph's already dead. They just don't know it. And they give these speeches all day. We're talking probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 2,000 people are in this meeting, most of whom are not members of the church. And some Whig rowdies, as they were called, towards the evening, break it up and start yelling and causing problems to the point where the police show up and there's a brawl that just is pretty violent. Several of the policemen are hurt really bad. But when they finally get everything under control, it's the meeting is such a mess that it's dismissed. And they meet in a church the next day to do the next part of it. But the press, again, at that meeting is, especially the Democratic press, says very favorable things about the meeting as a way of pushing back against these Whig kids who'd gone out there and do this stuff. And the missionaries that were in that Boston area, in that Boston meeting, all said that that words like the group approved or felt much satisfaction from what was being said or whatever. And again, from what I've discovered from the newspaper accounts and from the journals of the missionaries, when it was liked, it was more the message than the man, right? It was more the message than the Joseph Smith, because most of the publicity about him had been
polygamy.
Had been negative stuff. And so that's what you see. You know, I often get asked the question, what would have happened if he, you know, hadn't been killed? Where would this campaign have led to?
Well, yeah.
And quite honestly, probably, unless there was divine intervention, right? We could never take that out of the equation if you're thinking as a Latter-day Saint. But without that, it's probably going nowhere. It's probably...
Would he have been as good as Ross Perot? Do you think he would have had that good of a showing?
No. I don't. I do think, obviously, he would have carried the LDS vote.
Evan McMullen?
Politics, you know, even back then, you know, a week is a year, right? So there's a lot of other things that could have happened that would have helped his cause, but probably not.
I mean, he wouldn't have even won Illinois, right?
No, he wouldn't have won Illinois.
He would have won Utah, but Utah didn't exist then.
But he could, right. But he could, you know, what ends up happening is we go back to home. When he's killed in the fall election, most of us vote Democrat. In fact, one of the electioneers who's native to New York City, David Rogers, he persuades all the Latter-day Saints and the people who were thinking that way, thinking on Joseph Smith's platform, to vote Democrat, to go back to vote Democrat, which is huge because New York had been trending Whig for 6 years now. And it's because Polk, the Democratic candidate, wins New York by a razor-thin margin that he becomes president of the United States. And part of the reason why it's so tight is there's this Liberty Party. There is an actual other third party that lasts longer than Joseph Smith, and it's actually their second go-around, that's an abolitionist party. And they do pull off some votes that were probably Whig votes that helped the Democrats. And so the only thing where I can see Joseph Smith's campaign affecting the general election at all would be if there had been enough converts, and that's where the majority of our missionaries, or the highest percentage of missionaries, go to New York. So if they had had more months to have more success in New York and created more converts and more political converts, there's a chance, a small chance, right, that they would have flipped enough votes away from the Democrats to then flip that state back to the Whigs, and then Henry Clay would have been elected.
Oh,
but again,
this is what year?
It's still 1844.
1844, okay.
But again, it's still...
So he could have been the Ralph Nader, right? Because
right.
Nader had the big problem in Florida.
Small chance.
With Gore and Bush.
Right, yeah, yeah. Small chance, though. Small chance that that actually happens. In fact, Joseph himself, and at one point, speaking with some other... politicians, and those same politicians said that, you know, maybe if he doesn't get as good a showing this time, then by the next time he might, you know. So there was this idea that maybe they would try again if they didn't succeed in 1844. But of course, the assassination makes it all moot.
Interesting. All right. Well, so let's move on in our time. So after Joseph Smith died, and then Brigham Young institutes theodemocracy here in Utah, or in Deseret, I guess is what they would have called it then. Let's talk a little bit about how when the Civil War came about, and you know, Joseph Smith had the Christmas Day revelation in 1832 about the Civil War. So can you talk a little bit about that issue?
Sure. So again, you know, when we leave the United States in 1846, it's a permanent decision. I mean, we're looking to get away from the United States, mm-hmm. and we get into the Great Basin, and it's Mexico at the time, and we create this theodemocracy. And sure enough, there's a war, right? The Mexican-American War. And the Americans win, and now we're back in the United States.
We're trying to leave, and we can't get out of the
right. state. And so it's only been a few years, and we're right back in it. And so this leads to this tension between the theodemocracy in what becomes now Utah Territory and the federal government that's going to go all the way up to the 1890s. Well, again, you'll remember that I said most of the electioneers, and of course the leading brethren of the church, felt like that the United States had rejected both the gospel and political salvation, and that God would, you know, rise up and vex them and punish them for that. And when the Civil War breaks out, they see that as a natural Section 87, right? The revelation about the Civil War, a Civil War starting. They see that as fulfillment of that, obviously, but also of the rejection of political salvation that Joseph Smith offered them in 1844. And so, you know, while we don't join the Confederacy, we don't really join the Union, we kind of sit on the sidelines, hoping for some, not all, but hoping for some, that it all falls apart. In fact, the Council of 50 that Brigham Young continues, this Council of 50, this governing council, political council, he continues that they kind of lead the theodemocracy in the Deseret era. And then after theodemocracy is established, they kind of go away. They stop meeting because they have the structure set up. It's inherent now in the actual system they have. But during the Civil War, he brings it back. He brings the council back. And they create their own legislature, which is the exact same people. And after every single after every single legislature session during the Civil War, they do a second one with the legislature of Deseret, and they do the exact same thing. It's like a shadow government, if you will. And in the public speeches that that Brigham Young and other leaders of the church give, they start to talk again. They start to bring back and talk more about this idea of the kingdom of God, which meant a lot different then than it means now. It meant the political kingdom of God is coming back. And they saw in the fulfillment of the Civil War, they saw the fulfillment that might happen. And we need to be ready to govern ourselves when the country collapses and then spread that government. And so you hear during the Civil War in a lot of the discourses that are given by the leaders of the church, that idea. And they even start to talk about, you know, hey, this government's here, it's been here, it's just waiting for the right time. But then, of course, the Civil War doesn't lead to the collapse of the United States. And we have to go back to trying to get along with the United States. And when Reconstruction is done, then the Republicans turn to us, the other twin relic of barbarism, polygamy. And then that's when the real difficult relationship with the federal government begins through the 1870s and the 1880s, leading up to the Manifesto and the creation of the state of Utah and all that other stuff, which really is all trying to destroy the theodemocracy, right? Plural marriage is great for them to attack. Polygamy is great for them to attack because it's sensational, it's great. But what they're really trying to do, because it's seen as un-American, is break up the relationship between church and state.
Yeah.
And so,
because when the bishop is also the judge,
right,
the federal government has to pull in Gentile,
right,
quote-unquote, judges, because they're trying to break this theodemocracy.
Yeah, and it takes them a long time, mm-hmm, because they planted the theodemocracy really well, and they'd given all kinds of powers when they created them to the probate judges and to others, where they could basically put them in their own courts if people were accused, right? And so it took a lot of different amendments and legislation from the U.S. Congress to finally kind of break down all of the theodemocracy.
Well, and they had to disenfranchise Mormons from even voting, right?
That's correct. Soon after, and remember, just like with we talked about the Relief Society earlier, this idea of theodemocracy, while it wasn't gender equal, I won't say that at all, there was more kind of participation than was happening in the wider United States for women, both in political causes, not offices, but both in political causes and reform causes. And the Relief Society was reestablished out here and played, you know, a bigger social role than the Relief Society of today, you know, would play. And soon after Wyoming gives the vote to women, Utah Territory does the same thing, and it actually doubles our votes, right? It's even a bigger, you know, for the Gentiles and the disaffected members of the church that are trying to create this opposition party.
So Wyoming was the first state, but Utah...
Well, both of them are territories.
They're both territories.
Yeah, okay. So Wyoming was first, but there are very few people in Wyoming. Right. So Utah's the very first territory that has a large population of women that are given the right to vote, and they exercise it. In fact, we're celebrating it this year, right? The State Historical Society is celebrating this fact that I believe her name was Seraph Young, was the first woman in Utah to vote.
Well, there's this question about who was first. Was it Utah? Was it Wyoming? And it feels like there's different answers to that question. Can you settle that question?
I don't think I can settle that question. That's not my area of expertise. But from what I understand, Wyoming actually had the legislation passed first before Utah. But it was, you know... But
Seraph Young was the first one to vote.
In Utah territory. Yeah, Seraph Young. And she and it's great, and we're actually in that time period, and even after the Manifesto, our women leaders here in the West are part of the women's suffrage movement in the United States. They're huge, but they go to Washington D.C. and involved in all of those kinds of things. And so, when, like you were talking about, when they disenfranchise us, this is the first move to disenfranchise women that have had the vote for the first time as well. And so, literally, the government, the federal government, is just completely squeezing us to the point of not being able to exist anymore for the purpose of destroying the theodemocracy. Yes, they want to get rid of polygamy because that's not the American way, and the Protestant, you know, the super religious Protestants think it's the evilest thing in the world. But the real objective, you know, always was that this, that there can't be this entity right in the middle of the nation now, right? Because it's coast to coast. That's not for sure loyal to the federal government.
Well, and it's also interesting to me because the reason why the federal government allowed women to vote in the first place was because what woman would vote for polygamy, right?
And it turned out all of them, well, not all of them, yeah, but all the Latter-day Saint women, or most, you know, vast majority.
And yeah. So that was an attempt to get rid of polygamy, which totally backfired on the federal government. And so they're like, okay.
Now we had double the votes.
Yeah, now we got to, we'll just take it away from women.
Right.
So that's really kind of an interesting episode. I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Dr. Derek Sainsbury. In our next conversation, we'll talk about why Joseph Smith's run for presidency was so threatening to non-Mormons.
The big issue is not what's going on in bedrooms, what's going on in courts. That Joseph Smith has power in his own city and nobody can reach him. And now and in their minds, now he's looking to extend that power to the whole nation, where he's going to become, you know, not just president, but king. And they can, you know, that's just not going to sit well.
If you'd like to hear the entire interview uncut, please subscribe to patreon.com/gospeltangents. And for just $5 a month, you can hear the entire interview without any interruption. If you'd like a paperback version of our transcripts, go to amazon.com and do a search for Gospel Tangents interview. Also, if you'd like to give the money to me and not Amazon, please subscribe on my website, and I'll be able to send you a transcript as soon as they are completed, and click the subscribe button. You can also find our latest information on facebook.com/gospeltangents, as well as we're on Twitter @gospeltangents. And don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts. The link is at tinyurl.com/gospeltangents, and you can subscribe there. Also, please give us a 5-star review. If you want to support all of the podcasts as part of the Dialogue Podcast Network, go to lyceum.fm, that's lyceum.fm, and do a search for Dialogue Podcast Network or Gospel Tangents, because, you know, that's a pretty cool one too. Thanks again for listening. Click here to subscribe, here for a transcript, and over here we've got some of our great videos. Thanks again.